Hi, this is Morgan Michael welcoming you to Kindsight 101, the podcast, where you'll hear from world-renowned educational leaders about the mobilizing power of kindness. I believe that we all have an innate need to be seen, heard, and understood. When we dedicate ourselves to kindness, the ripple effects in our schools can be life-changing. Through this podcast, I want to challenge you to question your assumptions, amplify your insight, and embrace a willingness to go beyond the status quo in education. Together, let's learn how to make a big impact, one small act at a time. Have you ever wanted to learn the key to raising successful, independent, and happy children? The key is not shooting for obedience. During this fascinating conversation, we explore how to sidestep power struggles, how to explain anger to a child, how to stay calm when children are pushing us beyond our limits, and how to maintain age-appropriate expectations of our students. We examine how to set boundaries with our brave new social media landscape and how to support children when they're demonstrating depressive or anxious symptoms. Finally, we explore the two strategies all teachers should be implementing to develop psychological safety within their classrooms. Hope you enjoy. Allison Reese has been teaching LIFE, Life Seminars, since 1991, with her main focus on parenting. Allison and her colleague, Dr. Allison Miller, have produced two books, Sidestepping the Power Struggle and The Parent-Child Connection. Her history involves a 12-year-old radio show, weekly appearances on the news, a private practice working with families, training other professionals, writing articles, and perhaps her greatest feat, raising two children who are now amazing young adults. You can find her online at lifeseminars.com. For more information, visit my website, smallactbigimpact.com, and search for episode 29. I want to thank you for the wonderful reviews that you've left for this podcast on iTunes. Your reviews make a big difference in helping other educators find this show. If you think that I'm doing good work here and you'd like others to get inspired and join our 21-day kindness challenge and movement, I'd love it if you would take a minute, head over to iTunes, and leave a review. Thank you so much. I'm Morgan Michael, and I am the founder of the Small Act, Big Impact Kindness Challenge. And so it's really rooted in this whole concept of kindness and the reciprocal nature of it, and the fact that on a neuroscientific level that we all benefit from being kind to one another, being kind to ourselves, that actually people get boosts of happiness hormone just by witnessing kind acts. So I really dug into this whole idea and thought, how can I bring this into the classroom? Because I'm an educator, and I thought the challenge would be such a fun way to sort of kick off this kindness movement and really intentional ongoing kindness effort. So that's a little bit about me. Mm. And I'm so interested in your message as a parenting guru, I will call you, because I think you have so many wonderful ways of expressing how important it is to honor children. And I think that that's a really big part of kindness, is how do we see and seek to understand children instead of sort of steamrolling them and feeling like we need to just have them be obedient beings that reflect ourselves. And so that's really the reason that I have you on the show, is sort of from a parenting and educational standpoint, how do we honor those kids? So
that's huge. That is absolutely huge, because people, you know, are still expecting a level of obedience in kids. And I would say, even after all these years of facilitating, which is coming up to 30, you know, one of the biggest complaints I hear from parents is my kids don't listen and they're disrespectful, instead of understanding the nature of a child.
Yes, exactly. And I think ultimately there's sort of this fundamental expectation when we enter parenthood, or even into teaching, that successful parenting or successful teaching looks like obedient kids. And so I think part of my mission is rethinking that and really digging into and challenging that whole assumption that that's what good educating and good parenting looks like. Because when we're able to actually do that and have a conversation, really an explicit conversation about that, then things can change a little bit. But I think it's kind of this background operating system that we really need to reevaluate and in a really explicit way. So I thank you for being here to talk about that.
Oh, my pleasure. Yeah, it's funny. I think that when you look at the life material, which consists of, 16 weeks plus, all of it is about understanding how children, normal children, behave, recognizing their unique and individual temperament, understanding how our behavior has a huge impact on the behavior of a child, and that includes negative impact, you know. And some of the biggest shifts that I see in my courses are when people, A, start to get their head around embracing normal children and where they're at, and B, learning to communicate in ways that are more effective, kinder, less aggressive. Those two things combined can create a great deal of positive shift in a family.
That's so great. And I think it's a really great entry point, because sometimes we think that, and we sort of reject this idea of sort of alternative parenting, because we think that it's really, really difficult. And what you're saying is ultimately that it starts with embracing and accepting your child as they are, instead of hoping that they somehow fulfill this vision that you have for them, right? So can you speak to this need for us to feel normal in our parenting and our teaching experience? I think all of us fundamentally have this imposter syndrome that makes us feel like we're doing it wrong, or that our kids will be somehow suffer because of that. And when someone reassures us that it's all normal, we somehow are able to relax. Can you speak to that?
Well, I'll give it my best shot. You might have to pull it out of me a little bit, because, my mind goes to so many places. But maybe what I can say is, the very first chapter of Sidestepping the Power Struggle is looking at the innate genetic components, that, the temperament traits of a child when they come into the world. And honestly, when people come through course number one, it's called I Gotta Be Me. Mm-hmm. And they spend 90 minutes listening to the genetic components of temperament traits. Mm. And how some of us, we have one child who can be highly distractive, distractible and active and impulsive and intense and, not adaptable. And we can have another child who is very focused and persistent and a mild reactor. And, we realize this is part of our child's makeup is genetic. They came into the world a certain way. And so it's not all about our parenting. So people start to see, number one, they start to see, my child's personality is formed both on genetics and on his environment and how he's parented and, his surroundings. So it's a combination of those two things. So right away, they start to see their child's behavior differently. They take it less personally, and then we go into, how do kids actually grow up so that by the time they're 21 years of age, have a sense of self-esteem and have an understanding that other people have feelings just like they do? While they go through it, two steps forward, one step back. And, it's not a straight line toward moral awareness. So then we talk about the fact that when kids struggle for independence, they don't want to do things you want them to do. Simple things like get in their car seat, eat a meal. they stop wanting to do things you're interested in. And that's because they're trying to form an identity. So right there, parents start to see, wait a minute, this isn't just disobedience. As a matter of fact, what they start to learn is obedience is actually very damaging to a child's self-esteem. Mm. So when a child is struggling for independence, they're taking two steps forward, they're trying to be the boss of themselves. You're not the boss of me. When we start looking at it differently, instead of thinking, I need to control this. Mm. So there's this letting go and this acceptance of, wait a minute, this is actually not just normal, but it's actually a very healthy part of human development. Mm-hmm.
I think that's such an important part. And like, I, I'd love to dig into that just a little bit before we talk about some of the actionable ways that, parents and teachers can do this. Because I think new parents often gaze down at their babies and envision them as this perfect little version of themselves. Yeah. And then as they grow and the child very quickly demonstrates that sort of age-appropriate autonomy to explore that, right? Yeah, to explore that identity within the context of their environment. Mm-hmm. Sometimes it can be embarrassing, it can be funny, but it can also be really difficult and shocking. So as teachers, and even as a parent, I've really reckoned with that myself, and sort of this idea and the separation of my child is not me. And despite that best effort, we still kind of have that, I think almost like that knee-jerk reaction to own their behavior. And so whether that's as a teacher, they're loud down the hallway and, you know, like there's different moments like that where we find ourselves owning it. So if we tie ourselves to that behavior, it can feel like a lot more is at stake, right? And so this idea that the stakes feel higher. And so why do you think it's damaging to sort of connect our own adult identity so deeply with that of our students or children?
Well, we end up holding up an agenda that a child is usually not able to satisfy.
Right.
You know, if you look at self-esteem, for example, the true essence of self-esteem, there are three A's that we talk about to affirm a child who they are, not who we want them to be, their gifts, their interests, their feelings. So that's A number one. A number two is to accept the child, the child's temperament and their maturity level. Where is that child at right now? What's their best, you know, when they're having a hard day? And the third A is affection, which is no matter what, I'm always happy to see you. You matter. I care for you. In other words, I'm not rejecting you. I'm not neglecting you. And I'm not holding up a bar of perfectionism. You know, and it's the perfectionism that I'm concerned about, that we just think that kids should be able to act differently. And if we just say and do all the right things, then surely we can control this child enough to, you know, meet our requirements for what makes us feel good as a teacher, as a parent. And I think, you know, many parents come into our course feeling beaten down, feeling like failures, that they're doing something wrong. Some people come in still looking for magic tricks to control their child. And I think they're, you know, quickly disappointed to find out that that's not what we're about.
Yes.
And also moving over to the teacher realm, I've done a lot of Pro D days and have supported teachers individually. And, you know, often teachers burn out because they really think that they just are missing a tool or an approach that would get this kid over the hump.
Right.
So there's a real relief when we can see what we do and don't have control over, and a real sense of joy or enjoyment when we can go, okay, wait a minute, this is where Henry's at right now. Mm-hmm. This is his temperament. This is his maturity level. What are his needs?
Mm-hmm.
You know, how can I meet him where he is at? And so it's kind of like Ross Green, you know, in his wonderful book, The Explosive Child. He says, yes. if a child could, he would.
Yes. Yes.
So that encompassing, you know, of our ego, I am a good parent because I have a squeaky, shiny, well-mannered kid.
Mm-hmm.
Yes. And those are the kids that I worry about.
Yes, I totally agree. And I think this is why this conversation is so important, is because sometimes there is sort of this judgment placed on people whose children may not present as though, as though society would like them to, for example. And so I think sometimes that pressure can be difficult. And so a parent and a teacher has to sort of stand within their own strength and integrity and really own that understanding as well, that this child is developing their own independence and that their self-esteem is really, really important, more so than any expectations that we place on them. And I love your three A's because that's such an important and easy way to remember that affirm, accept, and affection. And I've spoken to quite a few people now on this podcast who are principals or educators who are really effective. And I actually had one really, really amazing principal who is now doing her own consulting, but she really changed a lot of schools in Philadelphia, schools that were very, very dangerous that no one wanted to lead. And she did that over the announcements. She would say every morning something along the lines of, "You matter. And if nobody told you that I love or that they love you, I'm telling you right now, I love you and you're important." And she said that every day, and she made really big commitments to connect with them just on a really basic human level in the lunchroom. And she said that's really fundamentally the major part of her program that changed the school around, is having even just one adult who cares enough to say that. And so I think about that from a teacher standpoint. It's not about fixing. It's not about
measuring up.
No, it's about just no matter what their behavior, they're deserving of that love and that affection. So I love that that's a point. What do you, go ahead. No.
Well, I just wanted to say something that I think is really important. How we speak is how we exist. And if we truly believe what we're talking about right now, separating behavior from the child, so separating the character of the child from their behavior is how we show that unconditional love. And this is where language is incredibly important. So not labeling kids, not attacking their self-esteem and their character, being able to make observations of behavior rather than using judgmental language. And so, you know, on one hand, we need to have this basic philosophy and understanding of, you know, unconditional love, which just simply says you already measure up. I want to support you to be your best. We know that when children have healthy self-esteem, they are motivated by the hope of success, and they can learn through failure with healthy self-esteem. But again, I just wanted to point out how important our language is.
Yeah, I think that's really, really important. And I think even around, I will totally butcher the quote, but someone interesting said that that essentially the voice that we use with children becomes their self-talk. And And I think that that's such an important thing, is that when we're talking to children, like you said, that the language is really, really important. So what do you say to parents who, or even to educators who say accept the behavior? How can we accept something that may not be appropriate for school, or, you know, and what does accept actually mean?
So I love that question. So I write little articles every month for Island Parent magazine, and one of them is called Acceptance Versus Approval. Mm-hmm. You know, and so I may not approve of you calling me a butthead, but I accept that when you are triggered emotionally and overwhelmed, this is the best you can do right now.
Mm-hmm. And that comes from a really compassionate place, I think.
Yeah. And so, you know, behavior is how children communicate. And until their emotional needs have been met, you're going to see behavior, because they don't have the ability to express themselves. Now, they can have a great feeling vocabulary, and this is where people often say, well, wait a minute, my kid has an incredible feeling vocabulary, et cetera. But it doesn't mean that they can access those feelings when they have them. If a child is stressed or upset, you know, typically a four-year-old will say, "I hate you." You know, butthead, poo-poo, bum-bum underwear to add, you know, to that. And then when they're a little bit older, they say they hate themselves. "I wish I was dead." I mean, children don't express themselves well. They act out their feelings. They become their feelings. And so while we work with behavior, we work with it and we describe it specifically. So we're not using evaluative terms. You know, we're just describing behavior, and we're supporting the child to understand limits instead of just pushing limits on them. Kids really need to understand why we have all these rules. And you know what? To tell you the truth, a lot of the rules we have don't make sense to kids. Right.
And really, I would say sometimes are just based in the understanding that this is what we do at school, because this was my experience. So now as a teacher, I'm going to perpetuate sort of that status quo.
Absolutely.
So So that's an interesting point as well, is sort of what would you say to teachers or even parents for that matter, who are trying to establish, you know, house rules or classroom rules? What would you say are some really important guiding principles when determining what those important baseline rules are?
Well, one of the things that we do in our course is we ask families, and when I do Pro D days for teachers, to think about what are kid issues and what are school issues or family issues. Mm. So if I'm working with families, I ask them to think about the rules that really matter. And the rules that really matter are usually social rules, the rules that we all go by. Mm-hmm. You know, they have to do with safety, respect for people's privacy, for their things, you know, respect for their bodies. But these are rules that make sense to everybody. In other words, they are the rules of the social order. Mm-hmm. And so when it comes to working with families, I ask people to put kid issues aside and nag and threaten over controlling. When we do that with kid issues, we lose our authority over the issues and the limits that really matter. Mm-hmm. So, you know, it boils down to what are the rules that really, really matter, and how does this child understand these rules? How can we explain limits in a way that talks about people's needs, mm-hmm. or that hold up values?
That's so great. I would like to talk a little bit about, well, first of all, you've said that behavior is how young children communicate. It's up to us to interpret their behaviors and needs. So what do you think, beyond sort of basic physical needs, children most need in order to thrive emotionally? And then how do you encourage parents and or educators to seek to help them fill those needs, or to approach filling those needs or meeting those needs?
Okay. Love and belonging, mm-hmm. Emotional safety. And I really want to stress emotional safety. Children are, again, very sensitive, often to their environment, to the words we use. One of the key factors in supporting children is to identify triggers that interfere with their learning, or that, you know, interfere with that feeling of emotional safety, autonomy, you know. So we call it antecedent management. Mm. And so as parents and educators, we need to be able to see what might be interfering with our kids' needs being met. Mm-hmm. You know, so like a solid example of that might be, you know, a child acting out with behavior, mm-hmm. and we don't know what's going on. We need to be able to connect with that child, to have some sort of opening so that they're able to communicate with us in a way that they can trust that we're not going to judge, dismiss, take over their problem, advice give. And if we can have this kind of connection with a child, we can often find out what's going on in their lives. And sometimes it might be bullying, or they're struggling at home with something, or, you know, who knows what it might be.
Mm-hmm. I think that's a really, really important thing, is sort of, yeah, this anticipatory approach to behavior in the classroom and at home, even, is sort of being aware of, like you said, what are the trigger points? And some of the ways that I've done that just at the beginning of the year is talk about that a little bit with parents at the parent-teacher interviews, or through questionnaires even, because they'll know their children better than you will in September. And so, of course, it's important to sort of bring the parents into that, and to anticipate that this kind of stuff may come up. And some of the kids who may present as very typical and easygoing may have, you know, I had one situation in an art class, and I think it was sometime in November, and it was a child who put really high expectations upon himself. But up until that point, he had been a very calm, relaxed, easygoing guy, but his expectations for this particular art project were so high. Mm-hmm. And had I not known this sort of by talking to the parents ahead of time, I wouldn't have been aware that this could be a possibility, or how to talk him down when he was feeling really upset and starting to shut down. So I think those are important things to look into. Can you think of any additional ways that teachers might be able to, or even parents might be able to, become more aware of trigger points?
Well, actually, I've got an analysis sheet that I give to teachers and parents, which is trying to pinpoint antecedents. So antecedents can be anything from basic physical antecedents like hunger and fatigue or overwhelm to the environment. We know with the self-regulation movement, et cetera, that a lot of kids are just stressed because of their physical sensitivities. So again, on a basic level, hunger and fatigue, it can be that simple, and it seems so obvious, but you know. And then other antecedents can be events that are going on in a child's life. So when a family phones me and says, gosh, suddenly we've got this behavior in our child, I'll often talk to them and say, you know, what happened around the beginning of the behavior? And it might not be something that parents think is a big deal, like getting a new puppy dog. But it's a change and it's stressful, and you know, so events can be antecedents. Temperament can carry a lot of antecedents. So children who are very distractible, you know, having trouble with organization, not hearing instructions, daydreaming, having a hard time just focusing on things they're not interested in. The traits that really show up are kids who are not adaptable, and they can be kids that can be perfectly behaved at school, you know, because they have a rule book of how they think things should go.
Right.
And they can get very upset when people aren't following their rule book, especially same age peers, you know, and they have this sense of fairness and justice. And
yes. You know,
those kinds of things can really upset them. Transition is another antecedent. You know, just some kids do not do well with transition, stopping an activity, starting an activity. Some kids are very cautious and have negative feelings about starting new things. You know, so there's really a lot of areas. Basically, an antecedent can be anything. It can be bullying.
Yes.
You know, it can be feeling insecure about their work. It can be anything, but the key is to be able to have enough of a connection with a child so that we can pull out what's going on for them. You know, because the problem is, and years ago, just to back up a bit, when I started doing Pro D Days, I called them front-end teaching. And it was to get away from overusing punishment and reward.
Yes.
And to start looking at the front end so that we're able to support children, you know, where they're struggling, where their skills are undeveloped, you know. Even things like, do they know how to deal with social situations when they feel overwhelmed? And
Yes, I think those are really important things to touch on. Absolutely. And I love all the examples that you gave too, because you're right. I think sometimes it can be very easy to look at things through our adult lens and to sort of miss the triggers, because we wouldn't necessarily identify with that as a trigger. And I think part of this whole, even the trauma-informed movement, and I did actually just have a conversation with Dr. Stuart Shanker about self-regulation for this podcast. Yeah. And So, it's wonderful. It really all kind of comes together and supports, you know, all of these messages are really, they interlock. But this idea that when we take away the judgment and the assumptions, that a lot can happen, and we stop saying this is how it should be, and we sort of give space for the way that things are going to roll out, whether it's positive or negative, and whether it's a surprise or not. And I think when it comes to responding to those triggers and the children who are being triggered, that when we sort of take our focal point out of it and we can expand our own lens, I think that's really powerful. And we take that shaming out of it, right? Because I think some of that emotional behavior can kind of become entrenched or the reactionary sort of behavior can become entrenched because of the shaming that they might respond to on top of it. So it's like this new trigger, right? And so it's just a really fascinating conversation, I'd say. I'd like to talk a little bit about Anger Mountain and sort of within the context of fight, flight, or freeze, maybe some of the ways that, first of all, we can conceptualize this climactic anger sort of expression, and then also maybe some ways that we can help students to become aware of their own sort of anger mountain and some of those responses? Does that make sense? It was kind of a convoluted question.
Not really. I mean, anger mountain is certainly something that I talk about quite a bit in my courses. I'm not sure if you're aware of that.
Yes, yes, exactly. Okay. I am. Yes, I was hoping you'd talk about it. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, let me kind of take a different approach. And one of them is when we as adults look at our own anger and intense emotions, it takes a lot of sophistication to be able to identify the feeling underneath anger.
Yeah.
You know, to be able to pinpoint, even to notice that we're in a bad mood. So, you know, as an adult, I can be in a bad mood and not even know it until my partner says, "Wow, you're really grumpy." And then I might argue with him and say, "No, I'm not." And then I hear the tone of my voice and think, "Oh, yes, I am." And then as an adult, I've got to be able to, first of all, identify that I'm in a bad mood. Secondly, trying to figure out what's underneath it. And thirdly, I've got to put my finger on the beginning of where this mood started.
Right.
And, you know, so it's a very sophisticated process. And we need to have a level of awareness to identify feelings as they come up. And children don't necessarily have that ability.
Yes.
You know, often for very young kids, they don't even know the difference between hunger and tired at
right.
times.
Oh, yeah, that's true.
Yeah. And so you can have, you know, things that happen throughout the day for a child, not to mention, you know, the hunger and the fatigue and all of that. And suddenly they get to that point of no return where the stress hormones take over and now they're having the big one,
mm-hmm.
you know, and they're losing it and having a major temper tantrum. And then they get it out of their system, literally.
Yeah.
And then they can spiral into a sense of shame.
Mm-hmm.
Because they feel so horrible about what they might have just said, you know, when they were in lizard brain.
Yes, exactly.
Flight or freeze, you know, or highly anxious. And so I think how we can work around this is I love helping children understand the science of the body, you know, just what happens to the body when the amygdala gets triggered and we go into anxiety and, you know, the fight, flight, or freeze. I think kids need to understand that for anger too.
Mm-hmm.
And when we can, and I keep going back to reflective listening, but when we are open and able to reflect a child's feelings, we are able to help push the release valve for them so that they're not necessarily going to keep climbing Anger Mountain. You know, we have windows at the foothills of Anger Mountain.
Yes.
Where we can have dialogue with kids. How we release negative emotion often is to express our feelings to a caring other.
Mm-hmm.
You know what it feels like yourself when you're upset about something and you talk to somebody and how good it feels if they actually just let you talk and they actually understand you.
Yes.
But you also know what it feels like to want to talk to somebody and have them take over or judge or minimize your feelings, you know, or mm-hmm. tell you what to do. It shoves the feelings back down. So here's the thing. I think when we can sit back a little more with kids and just give them that presence and give them a chance to have some understanding of their feelings, they go to Anger Mountain less.
Mm-hmm.
I did a research project for a couple of years with teachers and psychologists just to ask the question, what is self-regulation? What are the triggers and what actually helps children? And it, you know, there's a lot of information that I got from it, but one of the big ones was, well, there were two actually. The first one was have a relationship with this kid. If a child doesn't think that you like him,
yes,
they don't have that emotional safety. So a relationship where you have a sense of knowing that child,
yes,
you know, And the other thing was drop the agenda to teach a lesson.
Mm-hmm. Yes. And I think that's a key one, I think, is just mm-hmm. sort of listening stop without teaching. The agenda. Yeah.
Because when we're listening and we have an agenda that we want this child to learn something, or even tell me why you just had a 5-minute timeout instead of how are you feeling now? You seemed overwhelmed. And, you know, and or and then to make matters worse, to then force an apology.
Yes, exactly.
You know, when the child is just in complete overwhelm. So
that's so
not sure if I answered your question, but that's what comes to mind there.
No, I think that absolutely did, because I think sometimes, like you said, we're looking for this magic bullet or this magic, this magic strategy that somehow makes all of this go away. And I think really the reason I really wanted to talk to you is this idea that, no, it's sort of the same thing. I mean, obviously we're not friends in this role. It's not a friendly role, but at the same time, it's giving people that presence, as you said, and the listening ear and the seeking to understand, not to teach, not to impart some kind of wisdom, not to give advice, and not to own it, but to just let them experience that within kind of the holding hand of your safety. And I think that's the key part, is when we're able to sort of normalize their behavior on some level and normalize the experience, and then sit alongside them and have that not be, have our acceptance of them not be conditional on their behavior. I think that really, that just lets everyone's shoulders down, right? And I think it allows kids to just not add that layer to their struggle or their stress. It's just, this is what it is, and they're not going to be punished for that necessarily, right?
So, well, exactly. And then, you know, there's a time to listen, and then when there is a time to relook limits, that is when the charge, you know, just isn't there. So I often say to parents and teachers, resolve issues at a neutral time, but not when a child is still upset or that kind of thing. And I really love the idea of holding up an issue and brainstorming with kids to pull out their ideas.
Yes, I think that's great.
You know, yeah. And the other thing it does is it says, I have ideas. I can be a problem solver. I don't have to come up with the perfect idea. There are a whole bunch of ideas. And that there are lots and lots of choices. And I don't even like to say bad or wrong choices. They're just choices that we learn from. And if it's not okay, we try again. Mm-hmm. You know, but decision making and learning that skill, being part of decision making, is huge.
Yeah, I'd like to dig into sort of setting limits a little bit more, and how we can be assertive parents and teachers, not authoritarian, but assertive, and still have that bottom line of, well, there are certain things that just are not acceptable. Because I think sometimes, and you did touch on this in terms of accepting versus condoning behavior, but I think sometimes people have a hard time wrapping their heads around the concept of discipline in a loving way, because I think you can go too far the other way and be super loosey-goosey, and that sends a really mixed message to children. So I know that you definitely, that's certainly not your message. And can you talk a little bit about some of the effective and healthy ways that we can create boundaries within the classroom and even within our homes?
I think the big piece is predictability, that kids know the expectation, which is such a standard answer to this, but, you know, that they have an idea of what those rules are and why those rules are there, and to look at the difference between punishment and consequences. And, you know, I can imagine a lot of my colleagues kind of rolling their eyes right now, but you know, punishment clears the slate of wrongdoing. And so, in other words, to explain that, if we really want our children to develop to a higher level of moral development beyond punishment and reward, what it means is they have some understanding of how their behavior might have an impact on somebody else.
Yes.
So, you know, I often say in my classes, if your partner came home 3 hours late from a golf tournament, you know, would you go up to that person, grab their golf clubs and say, that's it, these are going in the garden shed for a month?
Even if you want to.
You might be tempted, you know, and add in a few other consequences and threats to boot. But really, what has an impact is for that person to hear how scared and worried you were, and you know, that you care for them and that you really need to hear from them if they're going to be home late.
Yes.
And it goes back to language. We maintain limits usually by expressing them.
Yes.
And if we need a follow through, if we somehow need to have a follow-through, that is something that we can even plan ahead. Not always, but often we can plan a follow-through. So a simple example is the classic riding without a bicycle, and this is just so important, and nagging isn't enough, so we're going to talk about what we do if there's no helmet. And then when we come up upon that decision, all I'm going to do is follow through. I'm not going to bring in my own anger, because if I bring that in, it's going to clear the slate of you actually getting the impact of, hey, I remember how important this is. And this is so important that mom, dad, or my teacher said they were willing to follow through with it.
Right. In a really calm way. And so that you're not adding this other emotion, which actually makes the whole situation worse.
Well, that's just it. You know, when we get angry and start shaming or whatever that might be, the actual impact of the behavior doesn't sit with a child. All they're doing is either feeling a lot of shame or feeling upset because they've been treated unfairly. And, you know, some consequences are too severe because they've come up with them in the heat of the moment.
Right.
You know, and so that doesn't get a child to move forward into a higher level of moral development, which is to treat other people the way you want to be treated. So in other words, when my kids were teenagers, they weren't perfect angels, but they would let me know if they were going to be late because they simply didn't want me to worry about them.
Yes.
Versus being afraid of getting in trouble.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. And I think that being afraid of getting in trouble can really cause some problematic behaviors, because then that's where children want to lie, because they'd rather lie than to appear as sort of disappointing in your eyes. But if you're able to come into or really send the message that you accept them no matter what, that you will always love them. And I think that really is an important piece as well, because I think, there can be some problematic behaviors that come out of that sort of wanting to just do right and be perfect and all of that. So,
yeah. And the being perfect comes from, you know, the false basis of self-esteem, which is having to be good, having to be the best.
Yes.
Those are all false basis of self-esteem.
Yes.
The other piece, though, that is important, I was just teaching a parenting teens class the other night, and having respect for your own boundaries as a parent, you know, so that you're able to say to your family, and you know, you've got kids, say, in middle school or elementary school, to be able to say, I think that it's fair that we all contribute, you can have choices, etc., but to stand in your boots around your values and your needs, too. It's important to me to have contribution and be clear with limits that are reasonable, instead of getting stuck in something that I call the guilt anger cycle, where we've gotten angry, now we feel guilty and we want to be nice, while being nice gets us into trouble.
Yes. And you compromise your own integrity. So I would love to dig into that a little bit, the self-care piece as a parent. But then afterwards, if we can talk a little bit more about teens, because I think this is a really interesting portion of the conversation just before. And of course, being aware of your time as well. So just in terms of that self-care piece, we talk a lot about self-care as it relates to kindness, because in order to be generous individuals, in terms of our actions and our interactions and beliefs, we really need to nurture ourselves in parallel. So can you speak to that importance for teachers and parents to learn to reflect upon and manage and process their own emotions, their own needs in order to be effective? Because exactly. Go ahead. Yeah.
One of the things, you know, when I talk about the three ways we can experience feelings, we can be aware of feelings, which is our guide. So being aware of feelings points to our needs, and needs point to boundaries and limits. But if we don't have an awareness of our feelings, or if we discard them, we have, you know, a level of denial. And denial is about being nice. It's about putting other people's needs before your own. And before you know it, with denial, you end up with a whole stack of problems, let alone resentment, negative attitudes, and then going into the other way of handling feelings, which is lust, you know, which is screaming and yelling or doing something that feels good in the moment, but hurts you and everybody else. So denial, being nice, is a form of denial. Mm-hmm. Being in touch with your own feelings is how you can practice kindness. And this sort of overindulgent parenting seems to miss the parents' needs. The parents can put their needs aside so much that the child doesn't even really get a chance to come up against boundaries.
Yes. Yes.
So I'll give you a quick story that ties into parenting teens. Perfect. My kids are now close to 30 and doing great. When Lexi, my daughter, was a teenager, honestly, everyone in Victoria should send her a thank you card. I mean, she really put me through my paces with her independence, you know. And when she was about 15 or 16, she had her best friends. They'd come for a sleepover, which I used to see as a privilege, not a right, because they were a lot of work, you know.
Yep.
And I realized that Sophie and Emily were actually able to stay out later when they stayed at my place. And that didn't sit well with me. So I phoned the parents and said, what time is their curfew? And anyway, I said to the girls on a Friday night, before you go out, I just want you to know that I'm really uncomfortable with the idea of you staying out later than you're allowed to stay out at your own place. So this is the time that I expect you home. And I just want you to know that if you are going to be late, I'll drive you home. When you get here, and I've let your parents know. Mm-hmm. Now, Lexi was looking at me, rolling her eyes, just thinking, oh, yeah, sure. But it was a feeling of discomfort for me.
Yes.
And I needed to pay attention to that. And so the interesting thing is, I never know what late really is, but they didn't put too much guesswork into it because they came home a good 45 minutes late that night.
Oh, no.
Yeah. And I think the natural consequence that was horrible is Lexi had to see me in front of her friends, me in my flannelette nightie. And I threw on my Uggs. But I could just simply say to these girls who I adored, okay, girls, don't worry about taking your shoes off. I'm just going to drive you home.
Yeah.
I didn't have to really say anything. And interestingly enough, I felt a level of appreciation. And to me, respect is having a solid rule that makes sense to me and being able to stand in my boots without being over controlling mm-hmm. of other people. And, you know, by the time our kids are teenagers, that's pretty well what we're working with is our own boundaries, because we're not running around applying consequences. But in this case, it was my own personal boundary that I could, you know, apply.
Right. Yes. Yes. Yeah. And I think that's so important. I think teens, I mean, any age group can be difficult, but certainly teens can bring with them all sorts of just the hormone changes and sometimes unpredictable behavior. And mm-hmm. so I think sometimes it can be really easy to judge, for example, teen girls in terms of their shallowness or the way that they do roll their eyes, really perhaps behavior that they're trying on, like dress up clothes just to impress their friends or just to fit in and to see what it feels like. But how can we sort of put a pause on that our own judgment about that behavior mm-hmm. in such a way that it actually enables us to be better at supporting them as teachers or as parents?
Well, it's really identifying their needs. You know, we do a lot of education on drinking and driving and safety. But, you know, if you think about the most terrifying thing for a teen is to not have a sense of belonging. Mm-hmm. I used to hold up various need words with my kids. So here's another example. You're going to get a real sense of my daughter now. She came to me one day when she was almost 16, still 15. And she said, Mom, I want to go to a party where there's drugs and alcohol and no adult supervision.
Wow.
And, yeah, I know. And while I wanted to say over my dead body, I knew that I needed to connect with what was really, really important to her. Because if I didn't do that, she wouldn't be able to soften enough to hear about my need for her safety.
Right.
And just to be able to reflect, it sounds like you're really curious about what your friends are doing out there and also that you'd like me to know what you're up to. And just having that kind of connection and then being able to validate their feelings and needs, but not necessarily the strategy.
Mm-hmm.
I get that your need for belonging and curiosity is super important. I'm not thrilled about the strategy. Mm-hmm. You know, can we look at a different strategy? Or what could this look like so you get your needs met to a degree and I get my needs met too? And that was how I navigated through those years. because we can have conversations where our needs were met, sort of.
Yes.
Not completely one
sure.
way. Sure. You know, but
sure.
Sort of.
So that she was understanding that you were willing to hear her out, that you weren't just going to say point blank, absolutely not, and yeah. not give any reason or not really have her come to that conclusion on her own, that perhaps that's not the safest avenue to, like you said, meet your needs.
Yeah.
Yeah. So when it comes to, I guess this is sort of a bit of a left turn, but into that emotional piece and that emotional health of teens. I know that you've talked about the way that depression and anxiety can present differently in girls and boys, and that we sometimes as a society have different approaches to how to support both girls and boys. And I'd love for you to speak a little bit to that, you know, all girls experience pain in their teenage years, in that development, and that often that pain is sort of blamed on themselves or on their own failures, and it can manifest as depression or even that anxiety, and it can show up sort of in anger in different ways, and sort of that pushback against the parents, and there's so much going on. So first of all, how do we maybe identify when our girls are going through some depressive times or experiencing depression type symptoms, and then how can we support them in that?
It is tough, you know, because the question when you're parenting, is this a mood? Is it situation related? You know, am I seeing enough flatness here that's been going on for a period of time where now I really need to be concerned? Is my child still engaged, perhaps in things that I'm not thrilled about? But is my child, you know, still enjoying friendships and having an interest in things? Or am I seeing my child unplugging and losing that sense of curiosity? And, you know, so again, it goes back to connection. Mm-hmm. You know, and I think the big thing is we've got to put ourselves in their shoes and think about how tough it is to be a teenager. Teenagers see anger where there isn't anger. Mm. So they can misread our facial expressions and think that it's anger. Mm. Again, they're trying to fit in and all the other things that you mentioned. So it really does go back, and I hate to keep repeating myself, but it really goes back to a connection with our kids.
Yes.
It goes back to our own self-regulation. We also have to learn not to sweat the small stuff, and there will be certain behaviors of our kids that we actually need to ignore.
Right. So like the eye rolling and that stuff that might ultimately trigger you on some fundamental level, but really isn't important to really focus on.
When that's happening in that moment, for you to hang on to your power, I used to call it interior, my inner Tahiti, you know, to just tap into, she's a teen who's doing the best she can right now with big emotions.
Right.
So not taking it personally, managing our own emotions, watching our language, having a connection. And one of the big things that I came up with is, so many questions feel intrusive to teens because, you know, you think about what they're doing developmentally. It's about forming an identity aside from their family.
Right.
So they stop wanting to do things with you and become critical of you. I couldn't yawn, breathe, or talk properly for a while there. but, you know, just really think about pulling back a little bit, you know, how teenagers go from being dogs to cats. You can't treat a teen like you're still a dog owner. You have to treat them like cats, you know,
that's
put
so
the
funny.
Dish down and walk away.
Yes.
Because cats don't come when they're called. They stare at you and ask you, who made you God, when you make a request of them. They're on their own time, you know. So, yeah. And so the task of being a parent of a teen is to have a connection and let go at the same time. The connection is keeping an eye on how they're doing emotionally. Being able, see, you get fired as a general contractor, but you want to be hired back on as the consultant.
I love that.
Well, that's Mary Pfeiffer in her great book, Reviving Ophelia. She was the originator of that philosophy.
Yes.
But you're not going to be hired back on as the consultant if you're constantly teaching, using aggressive language, putting the teen down, being intrusive, asking too many questions. It's just not going to happen.
Right. And so what would you say to a parent and, you know, who may feel like they're losing that sense mm-hmm. of connection and mm-hmm. so wanting to really desperately hold on mm-hmm. to that connection and also knowing they've got to play it cool because it's a bit of a, it can be a bit of a mind game, you know, not knowing how much, too much, you know, not enough. And
this is a conversation, honestly, that I just had the other day with parents, a couple who are worried that their teen is somewhat suicidal, you know, and on one hand they go, well, wait a minute, it's just normal teen behavior. We need to still have some rules and limits around here. And then on the other hand, they're just wanting to get their child through this really turbulent time. Yeah. And so in our course, and this happened in the fall when we were running sidestepping, you know, I get 80 to 100 people in my 8-week courses and I've got, you know, 16, 18 volunteer facilitators. And in our parenting teen group, probably 12 out of 14 parents had a crisis going on with their kids,
yeah.
either suicidal ideation, cutting, young kids not living at home anymore. And we were all pretty overwhelmed with the point of crisis that was coming into our course. But every single parent, with the exception of one, turned things around.
Wow.
So that they had a connection. And it was about the things that we just talked about. It was understanding how children behave, that they get prickly, that they perceive anger where there isn't any, that rebellion isn't all bad, that they struggle for independence. And the big piece was listening. And just quickly, one other one is a woman came into our course a dozen years ago saying, my daughter is 15 and she's about to get on a bus tomorrow morning to join a cult in Kelowna.
Oh, man.
Oh, yeah. And I was doing first night of the parent-child connection, and it was just listening. And she met her daughter the next day for coffee before supposedly getting on the bus, and she did an amazing job of listening. And as corny as it sounds, her daughter didn't get on the bus. But this was the beginning of turning the relationship around for this mom.
Wow. And it was really just about tuning in, listening without an agenda, and just giving her the floor and being there, just being there.
Because the truth is, you as the parent are probably the only person in that teen's life that can do that for them. Their friends can't.
That's really powerful.
Yeah, it was. And actually, this woman came on board as a group leader. You know, her daughter was a straight A student, and mom realized that she said, I was a perfectionist. I held the bar too high. I was over controlling. And she said, it was my own fear that stopped me from really connecting with my daughter in a genuine way, just to stop teaching a lesson with every word I spoke.
Yeah.
And so at the end of the day, it goes back to relationship. It just does. And you know, when kids have healthy self-esteem, they develop healthy friendships, relationships, they take healthy risks, they try new things, they get through failure and recover. You know, again, they're motivated by the hope of success. And so self-esteem isn't thinking you're better than, it's not thinking you are the special person in the world, it's no greater than or less than anybody,
mm-hmm.
you know?
Mm-hmm. I think that's so important. Thank you so much for that. There are so many different directions that we could go. And I think ultimately people will just be so interested to read your blog and to really dig into your parenting courses because, and your books, of course, because you have such a wealth of information and strategies and tactical approaches that can really, really help parents and teachers. So I thank you so much. I do have rapid fire 5 questions around kindness. But before we zip to that, is there anything else that you'd like to touch on that you haven't had a chance to really express today?
I think just we have talked about it, but I think the idea of self-care and, you know, really, when you think about parents who have very young kids or even parents with teens, it's so easy to get hyper-focused on the kids.
Yeah.
And you know how the best thing we can do is think of the 3 legs of the milking stool: self-care, couple care if you're in a relationship, and child care. But balance that out.
Yes. Yes, I think that's really, really important.
Yeah.
So here we go. Are you ready for them?
I don't know.
they're pretty relaxed. It's just sort of in a couple words or less if you can. So could you define what kindness means to you?
It is checking in with yourself to see if you have a wholehearted yes.
Oh, that's so good. I love that. What book or books have you gifted most often to people?
Oh boy, you're going to get me there. I hate to say this, but it's The Parent-Child Connection. And I'm not trying to self-promote.
No, but that's great.
It is the book that I give away so much that, yeah.
I think that's great. And I think people, we have had quite a few authors on the podcast, and that definitely is an important piece, is to talk about your own book. And I think especially because yours has so many important strategies and approaches. So I think that's great. That's great for people to know. What one skill or superpower does a teacher need to lead with in order to be effective?
To be present for a child and get their agenda out of the way.
Hmm. What about for a principal of a school?
Hmm. Oh, boy. You know, I think about principals and how they're pulled in so many directions.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And doesn't it go back? Doesn't it go back to being able to connect at all levels?
Yes. Yes. I think so, too. And finally, what message or quote might you print on one of those big quote cups that are sold in bookstores across the world?
Just because you think it doesn't make it true.
Thank you so much, Dr. Allison Reese, for being on this podcast with me. I really, really enjoyed the conversation. And I know that many parents and teachers and educators will really enjoy learning some of the strategies and the ideas that we talked about. So thank you so much.
You are so welcome. Thank you.
This has been another episode of Kindsight 101, the podcast. For links to resources mentioned in this episode, visit smallactbigimpact.com and click on our podcast and choose this episode number. Now, I'd love to give my audience a heads up about my new book, which will provide ideas, actionable strategies, and inquiry-based approaches to creating a kinder classroom through serving the community. Subscribe to my blog for more information. Now, I would love to hear from you. What's the biggest insight that you gained from this conversation? Head over to our website, smallactbigimpact.com, leave a comment on our podcast page, or tag and connect with us on social media with the hashtag smallactbigimpact to share your inspiring story of kindness. Can't wait to hear from you.